Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for over 4 years now. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we sit in front of our radios, and we chat with each other, and we educate each other, and we learn from each other, and hopefully we get a little entertainment from each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will return with the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me through email, that would be for mailbag questions, that would be for offering a TechNet puzzle. We're always looking for them. They're as rare as hen's teeth. Or if there's some technology that's in the news and you have expertise and want to share it with us, contact me and we'll arrange some time for that. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some space or NASA-related story. Of course, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But if you want to contact me, my email address, among others, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. As always, I cut and paste interesting articles, YouTubes, and what have you, onto a link page and offer it to everyone, and it stays up there for the foreseeable future. If you have a case of insomnia and you want to read something that I found at least interesting, there's a particular YouTube at the very top of it that goes into a very good explanation about our present economics. I don't want to really discuss it here, but if you want to read it, you might learn a few things. There's a chat room available. Sometimes it's quiet. Sometimes it's busy. Last week it was rather busy, which was a good thing. If you want to get to it, you type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And as always, I stream the TechNet on the Internet, and I leave it live, the feed, for the rest of the week because a couple people asked me. So if you want to hear the Glen Oaks repeater through the Internet, you type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to a link for that. And also I'd like to remind people Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. There's a lot of people that have moved away from the area, that unfortunately some have passed away and become silent keys, but their wisdom is recorded on audio files, and you'd be a better man if you, or woman, if you play a couple of those from way back when and listen to great guys like Mel, like Vic, like Eric. A lot of very smart guys have come and gone through this technical net. So keep that in mind. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what we got planned. Okay. Not really that much going on in AI this week, surprisingly. Nothing amazing announced. I guess economic news has kind of pushed AI off of the front page. But I do have a little comment to make about the FCC's docket listed as delete, delete, delete. So I will kind of give you a couple of present-day up-to-date news on that, and then we shall go to the regularly scheduled questions, comments, and topics for discussion. I'll ask people to hit the push to talk and ID with their call sign, their first name, and whether it's an amateur-related question, comment, or whether it's just a generic technological or science-related one. And we'll make up the list, and we'll try and go according to the list. We do allow for a little adjustment. That should take us to 10:15. Paul will join us for the SpaceNet report. And that should take us approximately to 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the week. So assuming everything works the way it's supposed to and continues to work the way it's supposed to, and I don't get thrown off of All-Star too many times, that's what we got planned. So let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what I know about delete, delete, delete as of pretty much today. Okay. As far as I know, the ARRL made their comment last week and have not uttered a single word on the docket since then. I could be wrong, but I couldn't find anything. What I did find is a report from Amateur Radio Daily. Actually, it's dated tomorrow, so this is news from the future. It says, Radio World reports close to 300 comments filed in response to the recent FCC public notice. Responses related to amateur radio vary from keeping the status quo to eliminating amateur radio licensing completely. They have alerted that says a number of the comments received so far has focused on amateur radio and the fear that ham radio could be at risk. The possible loss of spectrum is among the concerns. It goes on to say hams have until April 11th to file comments related to the public notice. Reply comments will be accepted until April 28th. The ARRL is also expected to file comments taking into consideration feedback from its members. So that's the latest and greatest news that I could offer you regarding docket delete, delete, delete. If anyone has any comments before we go on to the regularly scheduled stuff, feel free to hit that push to talk. Okay, I will take that as a no thank you. So we're open for business for the regular segment. Questions, comments, topics. If anyone has any, hit that push to talk. And again, give me your call sign, your first name, and what kind of a question or comment or topic you are interested in giving us today.
W2BZ, ham radio and computing.
And to HCN. Ham radio and science.
Okay. Rich and Wesley recognize. Anyone else want to get in line?
WA2VDH with a television scan-related video question.
Okay, John. Anyone else want to go on the list? Can you boost your amplitude a little bit? It sounds... Okay, I put you on the list, but you're something like 20 decibels below what you should be. So either put your mouth very close to the microphone, or if you could crank up the microphone preamp, that would be appreciated. Okay, anyone else want to go on the list? Okay, Rich, you're up first.
All right, good evening, Roy, and good evening, everybody else. First of all, I read a very interesting article in Wired Magazine, and it was an article about Q-Day, like in CQ, Q-Day, and what it was talking about was that's the day when a quantum computer figures out all encryption. Encryption of the blockchain, encryption of your bank account, passwords, encryption of everything, and encryption of power grids, and everything that's encrypted now, one day some quantum computer will figure out. They don't know whether it's going to be soon, whether it's happened already, or whether it's, you know, 50 years in the future. And the interesting thing about it, they don't even know if whoever does get to Q-Day, if they'll tell anybody about it, or just start bringing down air traffic and power grids and whatever. Anyway, it was a fascinating article, just fascinating, in Wired magazine. So let me let it drop a second. So before I go on, Roy or anybody else, have you ever heard of Q-Day before?
AP2GS. Yeah, I've heard of Q-Day. It'll be a week after they perfect fusion technology for the home. The problem is quantum computers is what we're talking about. Quantum computers cost millions and millions of dollars. They require helium storage because you have to super cool the damn things to be stable for long enough to do anything. And so far, the number of qubits that they've been able to stabilize and get the noise down, they've been able to... The whole point of this exercise and the way that encryption presently works is the need to factor massively large numbers. We're talking about numbers with 40 digits or 100 digits, they're the product of two prime numbers. So you could find your own prime numbers, you could multiply them. The problem is reversing the function. It's very easy to multiply two prime numbers. It's very difficult to find the two prime numbers that are the product that have that product. So it's factoring that's the big problem. And so far, quantum computers have been able to factor the number 15. It's a two-digit number, not a hundred-digit number. And they were able to figure out that it's 3 times 5, so congratulations to them. Now, this is using quantum computers that cost, you know, $20, $30 million, maybe $100 million, maybe $200 million. So the first group that are going to be able to have a significantly useful quantum computer is going to be a major government, so the Chinese, the United States, And so it's not going to be Joe Schmo working out of a garage that's going to break this. And they will use it with the NSA will use it to decrypt all kinds of fun stuff from the enemies. That's probably what will happen, if it ever happens, because right now they don't have too many qubits and they can't get rid of the noise. Different companies, Microsoft announced a really absurd thing that they had created a new state of matter. Lots of luck with that. And eventually, although their present experimental chip has, I think, 8 qubits, they think they can scale it up to millions sometime in the future. So, yeah, I heard about it.
Well, it's a fascinating concept. Talking about the end of Bitcoin, that would be the end of Bitcoin. So, and we don't know. It's 25 years away to be able to break all the algorithms that go into the blockchain. Is it 5 years away? Is it 100 years away? Don't know, but there is coming an end to Bitcoin. Due to quantum computing. Anyway, that's one thing. The other thing I wanted to talk about, actually ask about, we've talked about many times before, and that is the phrase, it just makes the radio happy, talking about tuners. We've heard that a million times. It just makes the radio happy. But in thinking about it, I'm wondering, what is the radio doing? What circuits are involved to make itself happy with a tuner? I don't know that. What is it, Roy?
Okay, to just touch on, again, quantum computing, no one has the faintest idea. It theoretically could be next year. I would seriously doubt it. It could easily be a couple of centuries in the future. And it not only would it screw up Bitcoin, it would screw up the banking industry, because the banking industry, all the encryption that goes on the Internet is based on factoring prime numbers. So everything breaks. But probably long before it's public that it was available and the NSA got to use it a little bit, everyone would have to just change their algorithms to a different type of technology that in early development there are different ways to encrypt things that would not be as easily breakable by super quantum computers. Getting back to your present question, it is the output circuit of your transmitter section of your transceiver. They are designed not inherently, not internally to be a 50 ohm impedance, but to operate in a specified manner under the load of a 50 ohm impedance. And that's what you want to make happy ultimately. And it's important, because if you don't make it happy, then you get reflections into it, and you need to have safety features that bring the power down. So now you have a low output power to protect your circuits, but you're not really transmitting much of anything anymore. So it's rather important to keep your transmitter happy. You need your transmitter. It's kind of difficult unless you want to basically just use the receiver portion. And even then, You don't get quite as strong a signal without adjusting the impedance going into your receiver circuits as well.
But what circuit in the radio? What circuit in the radio is looking, and how do they look at the impedance? How does the radio look at the impedance and decide what it is? Go ahead.
Again, when the electrical engineers are designing the output circuit, the final transmitter output circuit, they're designing it to operate optimally going into a load of 50 ohms. If it goes into a short circuit, it's not very happy. You burn out components. If it goes into an open circuit, it's not happy because it reflects back into the components and burns them out. And so, you know, a mismatch is a slightly better version of a short or an open. So it responds. The amount of energy transfer from a source to a load, we've discussed this before, Andy, may rest in peace, did a talk on it, depends upon the impedance of the source and the load. If you balance the source and the load, you optimize the amount of transfer of energy from the source to the load. If you don't, optimize it, and the reflected power can cause problems, and that's what's going on. So it's inherent in circuits. Circuits are all designed to deal with sources and loads. And if you don't design it correctly, and you have a significant mismatch, you have a much more inefficient circuit, and that could lead to damage to the circuit.
Okay, what is, if you have a huge mismatch, what is getting damaged and how is it getting damaged?
Okay, let's put it this way. You have a battery. You have a light bulb. You connect this with a switch, okay? You connect the switch. The light bulb lights. The battery gets a little warm, but it's okay. Now, let's change that load from, 100 ohms or 200 ohms to 0 ohms. So you're basically putting a piece of wire across a battery. Do you know what happens when you put a piece of wire across a battery? Have you ever seen when someone unfortunately decides to do that to an automobile battery?
Yeah, it heats up and it sparks.
And that's not good. You know, and also in the old days when hydrogen gas is given off sometimes, it explodes. So this is the simplest model I could give you for a source-load impedance mismatch. Of course, in that case, it's more of just a pure resistance because we're not really talking about an RF circuit. We're talking about a DC circuit. But same difference with impedances and RF circuits. You do not want a mismatch between source and load because, again, it's not going to be transferred. And if it's not going to be transferred, it's going to go someplace and do something you didn't want it to do.
Okay. Well, I will, I'll think about that. I still don't know exactly how it's doing it, how the source is figuring out that the load isn't what it wants. How does it figure that out? But, maybe I could, use DeepSeek to ask that question. The great thing about DeepSeek is it just doesn't give you the answer. It tells you what its thought process is, and that's fascinating. I read the whole thing. I read the whole thought process of it. Like I asked it last week, how did two musicians meet? And the thought process is, well, you know, it starts out, well, let's see. They were both born in Tulsa, but we don't know if they met in Tulsa. But they did, there was a radio label, and that radio label first had a musician A, and then eventually it had musician B, so that's maybe how they met. And it just goes through the whole thought process, which is very, very entertaining. Okay, let me let it drop.
Comment?
Yes, please.
A2GJE, I don't know if this helps. The output component, whether it be tube or transistor, can be damaged by A, excessive current, B, excessive voltage, over.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like asking, I don't know why the battery is upset by putting the piece of wire across it. Yeah, how does it know that there's a piece of wire across it, rather than the electronics of your car?
That's exactly the question, Roy. How does it know?
Well, it knows by the current and the voltage it's drawing. All of a sudden, it's drawing as much current as it possibly can through the internal resistance that remains of the battery design. So, you know, it's the components have an effect. The source has an effect on the load. The load has an effect on the source. It's not a conscious one. It's just the response to the components and the way they're set up.
VDH with a comment?
Sure, John.
Yeah, I think one way to think about it is that, remember, there is a tuned circuit in the output, and when you hook a matched load to that tuned circuit, if it absorbs power, then it reduces the Q. If the load that you put on that is not absorbing power, then that tuned circuit will have a very high Q. A very high Q can cause very high voltages to exist in that tuned circuit, which can damage the output transistors. In some cases, it can even arc over that tuning capacitor in that tuned circuit. I remember my old DX20 when it was not loaded right. As you dip the final, it was a very big mismatch. You could actually see an arc over in the plate tuning capacitor because of the extremely high Q and relatively high voltage RF voltages that are developed in that circuit. But
yeah, John, I agree. I mean, mismatches are very dangerous. I mean, that is why the practice is with things like antenna tuners is to tune your antenna using low power. Then you raise the power and retune and tweak. because if you just out of nowhere have some random setting for your antenna tuner and it's really mismatched, and you throw in the damn linear amplifier and blast 1,500 watts to get the tuner to tune, it's very possible to off and burn out bits and pieces of your antenna tuner. So impedances mismatches can get increasingly dangerous. And you don't even get to that point now, I think, with safety devices in modern-day radios. It'll just pin down the power. So you're trying to get out with 100 watts, and your transmitter is only going to give you about a watt to screw around with. So, you know, there's got to be some wonderful explanation that explains it to everyone. But, you know, I mean, it's the nature of things that sources and loads interact with each other, sometimes detrimentally.
John, could you define Q?
Yes, Q is the ratio of power stored to power dissipated. That's one definition of a Q. For example, if you have a very high Q circuit and you hit it with a pulse and watch it on a scope, you'll see it ring for a long time. If you have a low Q circuit and you hit it with a pulse, it'll ring maybe just for a couple of cycles and die out. So you can see what happens if the power dissipated, which should be dissipated in a resistive antenna load, is very small. That's going to cause that output circuit to have a very high Q, and that high Q can cause very high voltages to exist across the tuned elements. Go ahead.
Luckily, my radio does what Roy was saying. It backs off on the output. It doesn't let you screw it up. But it also says the internal antenna tuner will only tune something 3-to-1 or less. Why is that? Why is it only 3-to-1 or less?
That ratio... That ratio of what it can tune depends on the range that the inductor and the capacitor in that antenna tuner have. I remember Dick used to always talk about this. He said that a good antenna tuner, they should give you a chart where the regions of which it is capable of matching is plotted out. But if you look at a Smith chart and take an SWR circle, you open up the compass to a certain radius which defines a certain SWR, and you draw that circle, that'll give you the range of which that antenna tuner can transform an impedance into a purely resistive 50 ohms, which is what the transmitter wants to see. It wants to see a resistive load, because only resistances can dissipate power. It wants to see a resistive load of 50 ohms. If it sees a lot of reactance, inductive or capacitive, the reactances do not dissipate power. They store power and return it, but they don't dissipate any power. We want our antennas to look resistive because they will dissipate that power in the form of radiation, in the form of a signal being radiated. Okay?
What they're saying is we don't have room in the cabinet to fit big enough components to handle that kind of mismatch. Isn't that what they're saying?
Essentially, yes. To have an antenna tuner that could handle, say, a 5-to-1 or a 6-to-1, you would have to have a big roller inductors that have a good low resistance, possibly silver plated. And you would have to have capacitors that had a very wide tuning range. If you look at some of these automatic antenna tuners, you'll see sometimes they will switch in fixed capacitors to extend the range that they can tune over. But it really boils down to how big inductors and capacitors they can put in there to be able to cover a wide range, to be able to tune a wide range of impedances to bring it to 50 ohms resistance.
AC2GS, anyone remember me?
As I said, has an internal tuner. I also have an automatic tuner. And what I do to get the SWR down, I'm just going into a shortened N-fed half-wave wire, 33 feet of wire with a coil and a transformer. So that's what it's going into. So what I first do is I hit the tune button on the radio, and that tunes on every band, except I don't want to tune the tuner. So the tuner's in the circuit also. So what I do, after I get it low enough with the internal tuner essentially tuning the automatic tuner, I take the internal tuner out of the circuit, and then I touch up the SWR with the automatic tuner. And because I'm correct on use a tuner to tune a tuner.
Guys, stop quick keying. Thank you, AC2GS. I was trying to get through last 5 minutes. You can't key back and forth. I mean, it's bad enough you do it to the Echolink people. You do it to the net control operator.
Sorry.
Okay, you're forgiven. But try not to quick key. I know you kind of get into the conversation, and immediately when one guy stops talking, you want to start talking. But this is a net. This is not a telephone conversation. Anyway, the reason... The 3-to-1 is an approximation. John was very correct. Dick regularly said he would have loved for his antenna tuners to come with Smith charts, because that's probably the best way to represent the matchable areas of impedance. Because it's not only the SWR, it's the reactance, capacitive and inductive. They're different for different situations, and so a Smith chart gives you a much better indication than the magic 3-to-1. Some 3-to-1s that a 3-to-1 tuner can tune, there are some that they can't tune. It's just the nature. There's different types of circuitry that is used for impedance transformation. There are pi networks and T networks and L networks. They all have different strengths and weaknesses, so they would generate, even with the same components, different patterns. And the value, not so much the size, but the value for the inductance and the capacitance determines the nature of the ability to match circuits. The reason why your Japanese radio has an internal antenna tuner that tunes 3-to-1 is because that seems to be part of the psyche of Japan. They really don't believe in terribly mismatched antennas, and they consider it sloppy amateur radio practice to put up an antenna where the mismatch is anything more than 3-to-1. It happens to be less expensive than to make an antenna like my Palstar that can tune, in some cases, 10-to-1. But that's why 3-to-1 is the number that's mentioned. You'll see that all the Japanese auto tuning internals are rated at 3-to-1. Separate antenna tuners with stronger values in their tuning circuits can tune much wider.
HE2RY.
Yes, David.
Good evening. Talking about antenna tuners and the ability to read the SWR and the power output going into the antenna to judge the performance of the transmitted signal.
Okay, I mean, there's a lot of problems with that. Number one, you can put a wattmeter in front of your antenna system and see what the output power is. you can't really definitely say what the input power to the antenna elements themselves, because they're subject to reflection. So if you have a mismatch, you still got to read that you're putting out a lot of power through your line, but the amount of power that gets dissipated as radio waves could be minuscule, depending upon efficiencies of antenna and reflections and insertion losses and all kinds of fun stuff.
QSL. But I find that, you know, when the power output peaks at a higher level, like 80 or 90 or even 100 watts, you know, the signal somehow gets out better. Also, if I got an antenna analyzer, I want to put it in line from the radio to the antenna to make readings on the fly. Would that be a difficult thing to do, or would you suggest, you know, just get an LDG external tuner, 100 watts, get the SWR and the power output?
Yeah, I mean, most nice antenna tuners give you all that information at the side of the antenna tuner. That's usually the easiest way to do these things. You have to kind of know where you're supposed to put these meters as well. A long time ago, there was a kind of a confusion that someone mentioned. Your SWR meter between the antenna and the antenna tuner. And unfortunately, antenna tuners don't transform anything up until the antenna tuner. It's designed for the transmitter. If you put a wire between your antenna tuner and your transmitter, you'll see the SWR being corrected by the antenna tuner. If you put that instead between your antenna tuner and your antenna, you won't see any difference. No matter what you do to the antenna tuner, it'll read the same impedance, because the impedance is not transformed universally. It's transformed at the antenna tuner going to your transmitter.
Is it true that most radios these days, transceivers, basic transceivers, some more advanced transceivers, you know, that have those readings in the radio itself? Some of the radios have built-in antenna tuners, and maybe in some other device somewhere else, I find that I can use the readings in the radio and also in the antenna tuner, both at the same time.
Yeah, it should pretty much be the same signal. The meters in your antenna tuner are right before you go out into your transmitter. So the meter readings in your radio are pretty much close. You know, they might be slightly off and need to be tweaked a little bit, but yeah, they're equivalent.
Aren't I correct? Let me see if I have it. Aren't I correct in saying that I should not be using the internal tuner with the external tuner?
Yes, we talked about this many, 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 many times. You should just have one impedance transformer, especially an automated one, in the circuit at the same time. So the worst case scenario is to turn two automated antenna tuners on simultaneously and watch their algorithms go insane.
Well, it doesn't go insane. What I noticed was that if I just switch bands, for instance, and I don't retune, the SWR could be like 15 to 1. And you're right, Roy. What it does is it lowers the output of the transmitter so as you don't self-destruct. You know, you don't burn it up, which is great, because it's the first time that's ever been true in a radio that I've had, that it saves you from burning up the output transistors. But so let's say it's 15 to 1. if I throw in the internal antenna tuner, that brings it down to 3-to-1. If I then take that the internal antenna tuner out, the external antenna tuner, I can tweak down to, let's say, 1.4-to-1. So I start off by using the the internal antenna tuner. I start off by using that to bring down the SWR to a certain point, and then I take it out of the circuit and do the rest with my automatic tuner, which isn't really that automatic.
In what way does it benefit you to do this? I mean, my radios have internal tuners too. I don't use them. I use I have two very nice versions of PALSTAR. I have an automated version. I have a manual version if I'm in the manual mode. Why can't you just tune it with the external antenna tuner? I don't understand the need for the first set of things. It seems like an unnecessary step, and you really should try to modify your behavior. I don't think I have ever transmitted full power on an untuned situation, so I'm not quite sure exactly why you're triggering that safety feature. I mean, safety features are great. They're parachutes, but you don't usually want to need to use a parachute regularly.
Well, like I said, for some reason, in some way, the internal antenna tuner is, well, it's the radio's hooked up with not just the coaxial cables in and out, but it has another cable going from the antenna tuner into the radio. So they're talking to each other in some form. And the reason I do it is just it's faster that way to get everything in tune. For some reason, the internal antenna tuner works with the automatic external tuner, and it brings down the SWR, let's say, to 4-to-1, let's say, and then it's much faster to tweak that with the external antenna tuner after I take the internal antenna tuner out of the circuit. I don't know why it works like that, but if I see a 15-to-1 without the internal antenna tuner, it takes me more time to tweak the external tuner to get it down to, you know, like 1.4-to-1 or so. I don't know why, but that's where I do it.
Okay, hold on, guys. Again, don't quit key. It makes no sense to me, because when you turn off your internal antenna tuner, you are bypassing it, so there is no impedance correction at all, and so you're still correcting the impedance solely with your external antenna tuner. So not quite sure what's going on in your shack, but nothing like that goes on in my shack, so I don't know. Now, two people doubled with me once again, so please try not to quit key. I recognize David. We'll take David first, and then the other person will take second, I guess. So, David, what do you want to say?
QSO. Yeah, I use two antenna tuners. I use the internal antenna tuner, 3-to-1, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters, with the external tuner on bypass. On bypass, the signal just goes through. Then on 17 and 12 meters, I use the external tuner, which I use the button on the tuner. And passes through the radio. So that seems to work the best for me. And just to be careful not to try to tune from the radio on on 17 and 12. Try not to tune on the external tuner 40 through 10.
Okay, whatever works for you is fine. The FCC won't punish you. I won't punish you. You're using it one at a time, which is fine. It's generally bad practice to run two automated tuners simultaneously. Again, the FCC is not going to fine you, and I'm not going to go over and punch you, but it's just generally bad practice. But if you want to use the internal tuner for some bands and the external tuner for the other, you know, go crazy with it. That's fine. Anyway, the other person who quickied, you wanted to make a comment?
Hey, it's K2GJE.
Okay, Ed, what do you want to say?
Your tuner, whether it be internal or external, but never both, never corrects SWR. You evidently have a bad antenna. If you had a good antenna, you wouldn't need to make the final happy with some transformation at the tuner. I worked on some very, very high-powered equipment in Europe. They never let us go above two. They never let us go above two. Three was strictly forbidden. And since the transmitters were of extremely large power, anything out of that two area would cause a lot of damage, and that would be an expensive proposition. But the tuner is a Band-Aid. Years ago, I operated a net from an organization on four. I did not use a tuner. What I did, I trimmed the antenna to get the SWR down. When the SWR meter was happy, that's where the length of the antenna had to be. And I didn't use a tuner.
Okay, I understand where you're coming from, and in a perfect world, you should always use resonant antennas. That's the way the Japanese think of things. Especially, you go down to 80 meters if you like to fight with people, and 50% of the people will tell you that antenna tuners are a waste of money, and you're just fooling yourself and your transmitter, and it's worthless. And the other half will tell you that there's benefits to it, and that you have to pay a price, but there are benefits to it. So if you're able to tune your antennas, congratulations to you. Most of us are stuck with real compromised antennas, and even as additional to the compromise, unfortunately, when a lot of our antennas have, John mentioned it, a high Q, a relatively high Q. So that means they have a relatively narrow bandwidth. So if you have an 80-meter antenna up there that has some coils because you can't strew it all over your neighbor's property, it's going to have a high Q. And at the edges of where it's set to resonate, it's not going to resonate too well, and you're going to need something to allow you to use it for your transmitter. If I supply an SWR reading of greater than, I think, 1.4 to my expert linear amplifier, it'll squeal like a pig. So, you know, you need to add a 1.4 to 1 SWR is not a really terrible reflective loss if you really look it up. You know, some people tend to get very weird about SWRs and say that they have to be 1 to 1 or else what's the point of the exercise? So, there was another person who wanted to make a comment?
For some reason, my internal tuner is talking to the external tuner, and it's adjusting the external tuner to a lower SWR than if I didn't use it, if I didn't use the internal tuner. So, that's how they're working together. I don't know why they're working together or whatever, but they are working together.
Again, it simply does not make any particular sense to me personally. What I think is happening is you're talking about a signal wire that goes from your transceiver to your external automated antenna tuner, which is part of a tune circuit. So basically you press tune on your radio, it sets it it lowers the power, and it triggers the auto tuner to go into action. So I think that's what you're alluding to. It shouldn't be at all hooked up to your internal antenna tuner, because that thing is set to work solely with an external antenna tuner, not partially your internal and your external. Because, you know, I'm sure if you told ICOM that you like to use both, they would be very, very annoyed. So I'm not quite sure exactly what's going on there. But that signal wire is solely, as far as I would guess, a automated tune function of your radio with the antenna tuner.
I know, but that's not the way this is working. I'll just give you a scenario, and we could leave it at that. I have this NFED half-wave that I have had QSOs on from 10 meters to 80. Now, on 80, I'm just above the noise level to most people, but on 40, I've had extensive QSOs with guys, and no less on CW, it's much easier because the signals are easier to hear. But if I switch bands from 40 to 10, I push the tuner button for the internal tuner, that activates, because the light comes on, that activates something in the external tuner. Then I take the internal tuner out of the circuit, and then I adjust, let's say the external antenna tuner is showing me a 3-to-1, I then bring it down, or a 5-to-1, whatever it's showing me, I then bring it down easily with the buttons, with the inductor buttons on the external tuner. If I don't at first use the internal tuner, let's say I'm showing a 15-to-1, that drops the power of the transmitter, and then it takes me a longer time to get a low match on the external tuner. So this is the way it works. I don't know why it works that way, but it works, and I can quickly tune on any band using this method. But I definitely don't use both tuners when I'm in a QSO. I take the internal tuner out of the circuit. Go ahead.
EDH with a comment.
Yeah, John recognized, Howard, I recognize you. We'll get to you. I promise. I don't know what to tell you, Rich. I think what's happening is you seemingly don't like to lower your power to tune, so you have the radio do it by doing the internal antenna tuner, which knows to lower its power while it's doing the tuning. Otherwise, because for some reason you're not lowering the power to do the external tuning, you're getting the fold over and all kinds of strangeness happening. So that's the best guess I could have. So let's have some other people kind of talk. First John and then Howard. So John?
I was wondering, when he says that he takes the tuner out of the circuit, does this mean that it locks into whatever setting it has come up with? Because I have one of these automatic antenna tuners. I never use it. It's made by SWE, I think. But it has the ability to lock in some settings after it's done its automatic search. Now, if he says that when he says he takes the tuner out of the circuit, that it locks in a certain number, a certain setting, and then uses the other tuner to correct from there, then using two tuners, I could see how you could possibly arrive at the optimal or best tuning conditions using those two tuner procedure. I could see how that could happen if you lock in a certain set of conditions. The other thing to remember, of course, is that between the tuner and the antenna, you still have a high SWR. the antenna tuner just presents, lets the transmitter see a 1-to-1 SWR. It lets the transmitter see a 50-ohm resistive load. Go ahead.
Correct. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would think the way that Rich mentioned it was because he had to trigger it. It's not set to auto-tune by itself. He had to press a button to set up the tuner. So I'm hoping and or assuming that when he says he turned it off, he bypassed it. If he bypassed it, it shouldn't have any effect on the impedance transformation of his external. If he simply turned off the auto feature, then that impedance transforming circuit in the radio is part of the impedance transformation that's going on. So it depends upon when he says he turned it off. Did he basically just turn off the auto feature of it, or did he bypass the entire tuning section inside the radio? Rich?
Oh, I bypassed the... When I say I take it out of the circuit, I mean I turn it off, the internal tuner. I turn it off and then tweak the external tuner. But I think John said it best. Yes, they are definitely working together, Roy. I don't know how or why, but they're working together to get me closer to a low SWR. And then I get to a very low SWR by taking the tuner out of the radio and just tweaking the external antenna tuner from there.
Okay, I still don't understand. The way it sounds, most likely, the only way that this could work in my brain is that when you say turning it off or cutting it out or whatever, all you're doing is disabling the automated tuning circuits. It's manually locked on the previous setting to transform the impedance. So it's not in bypass, I don't think, because if you put it in bypass, it would have no effect whatsoever. You cannot have an antenna tuner set to bypass and have it affect the impedance, because it is not going through the impedance matching circuits at all. So I think what's going on is when you think that you're turning it off, you're just turning off the auto-tune feature and just locking it down to whatever transformation it was set to, and then going over to your other antenna tuner and further transforming it. So you could do it again. You don't get a ticket, but it's generally bad practice. So, okay, I think that's what's going on. Howard, what do you want to say about this?
Okay, the first thing is I apologize. I kept on the ID because I didn't think I was getting in. It looks like you have All-Star set up for Fruit Duplex, because every time I key up, I would hear people talking. I'm on the phone, so I didn't realize I was hurt. Second thing, these internal tuners, you can think of them as like a Pi network. You know, like you had an old transmitter, you know, an old plate. Type transmitter with a tube had a plate and a load control, okay? And then when they come out with solid state equipment, they use broadband tuning. So what they had to do was put an antenna tuner or a matching network. As far as I'm concerned, it's like the plate and load. And I don't see anything wrong in having the antenna tuner in your radio tuned to a external tuner. I don't see anything wrong with that. It's the same thing as having a Pi network, and that Pi network goes into an antenna tuner. It's the same thing. That's all these things are, these matching networks. It may not be a Pi network, whatever they're using, a T network, but it's like an input tuning circuit from the transmitter to your feed line. Back to you.
Yeah, I understand. Well, I mean, the reason why was we used to use transmitters that operated with vacuum tubes. Vacuum tubes are high impedance voltage devices, so you had to bring them down. They were nowhere near 50 ohms. And transistors, it's relatively easy to design circuits that are made for 50 ohms. But the difference is that Pi networks in the old machines were manual.
You didn't have automated circuits checking to see what the readings were and adjusting them on the fly. If you have two different antenna tuners with two different algorithms trying to auto-correct simultaneously, that could lead to some kind of flaky operation. I mean, okay, once again, if you're operating purely manually, I agree with you. But no one these days is operating purely manually. All these antenna tuners, for the most part, especially the internal ones, are automated.
I agree with you to that extent. But as far as you saying that there was an equipment that didn't have automatic tuning, Collins made some equipment that was